If money affects your life in any way, Money Making Sense will talk about it. Be financially healthy, wealthy, and wise. Here's your host, Heather Kelly.
Welcome to Money Making Sense, the show that talks about all things money. Today, we're talking about how much money the Beatles had or didn't have back when they were on tour. And joining me today is Ivor Davis. He is an author and journalist who traveled with the Beatles when they were first touring the U.S. in 1964. So welcome to the show, Ivor.
Thank you for having me, Heather.
I would love to find out how you managed to get the gig where you're touring with the Beatles. Because first of all, did you even know who they were when you first got on the plane with them?
The answer to the question, Heather, is that yes and no. Because don't forget, in 1964, communications was nowhere near as sophisticated as it is today. So back in 1964, I got a call from my editor in London for the London Daily Express, and he said, get on the plane. I was in Los Angeles, the bureau chief for the London Daily Express, a large newspaper with a readership of 4.5 million readers a day in the days when, if you can remember, people used to read newspapers. He said, get on the plane, go to San Francisco, the boys are arriving. I said, who are the boys? He said, the Beatles, silly. Oh, of course. But I didn't know too much about the Beatles. However, in February 1964, I turned on the television, as did thousands, millions of young people, and watched the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And 74 million people tuned in. And that was the signal for Brian Epstein, the manager, to take the Beatles to America to try and conquer America. And so I traveled with them for 5 weeks. It was an incredible journey. I can't tell you how amazing it was. I learned all about the Beatles. I saw them in action. And they did conquer America.
I know for my job, if I get sent out of state, my company picks up the tab. They cover all my expenses. Did the Daily Express pay your expenses, or was it the Beatles?
No, the Daily Express paid my expenses. What had happened was Brian Epstein's office had contacted my Daily Express office and said, look, we are having a private jet to take the boys all over. Ivor can travel with us. He can be on the private jet with us. But there will be a small charge. And to be honest with you, it was very minimal. I think, to be honest with you, the Beatles, mind you, they didn't have that much money then, would have given me a ride for free. The newspaper agreed. And as you know, basically I had expenses when I was traveling with them. I mean, the hotels were picked up by my office. My travel expenses were my food expenses were, so I got a free ride, and the Beatles, I think they took the whole jet and paid for it because it was a natural, of course. I mean, if there were 35 seats on the jet, the Beatles probably would have paid the same amount for a 35-seater. If there was only 10 people there, there were more than 10 people, including me. So, your long-winded answer, I didn't have to go into my pocket to pay to travel with the Beatles. It was a free ticket to ride.
Is that where they got the title of that song, Ticket to Ride?
I think, to be honest with you, they've written the song beforehand.
Okay.
But I wish I could say, hey, John, hey, Paul, I've got a great title for a song. It didn't happen.
So you briefly mentioned that the Beatles didn't have that much money back in 1964. I think today, currently, everybody thinks, oh, the Beatles were so rich, but you were with them right at the beginning. So were they still living hand to mouth?
Well, I want to tell you, this may be hard to believe, but in those days, the Beatles were not rich. I think Brian Epstein paid them something like £25 a week. I know it sounds crazy, and that was about $40 a week. And the Beatles, as I got to know them, never really worried about money. They had two road managers, Neil Aspinall and Mal Evans. And whenever the Beatles wanted money, they would go to Neil and say, give us dollar or $10. But don't forget, why would they want money? Because for the whole trip, they were trapped in their hotel, trapped in their jet, trapped in their limousine. They didn't get a chance to go shopping like you and I would go shopping. Because if they'd stepped outside their hotel, they would have been torn limb from limb. So they stayed home. And the only time I remember going shopping was when they went out in Dallas, Texas, Mal and Neil, and we sort of trotted along and they shopped and they bought Stetson hats and cowboy boots. And of course, Mr. Aspinall came up with the cash. But the Beatles didn't need cash. And I'll tell you one other funny story. I used to play Monopoly with John, and then I played poker with him, and I won money from John. John never paid me any of his losings. So, I tried, but what could I do? He didn't have any money. Well, he lost, and he didn't pay.
Well, I heard that many journalists that travel with them did try to subsidize themselves by playing poker with John because he was such a bad player. But you're saying that you say John never coughed up the money?
We got a call at 2 in the morning. John said, come over. I came over with Art Schreiber, who was the correspondent for the Westinghouse Corporation radio. And we would play Monopoly at 2 in the morning, and we would play poker. And when John lost, which he inevitably did, because as you said, he was a terrible poker player, we said, John, you owe us $5. He never paid. I don't know. We didn't go to court, of course. I'm being facetious here. But so John probably, over that 5-week period, owed me at least $20. And he never paid his debts. So I kind of cry when I think about it. I could have been a rich man back then with $20, but there it is. That's a missed opportunity.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. All right, this is a perfect place to take a break. When we come back, we'll move into a little bit later into the Beatles' lives when they did have money or were supposed to have money, but maybe their management company didn't help them out in that way. So we'll be right back with Ivor Davis. He is a journalist and author of The Beatles and Beatles on Tour.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on kslpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Money Making Sense, the show that if money affects your life in any way whatsoever, we're talking about it. And today we're actually talking about the Beatles and how money affected them. Joining me today is Ivor Davis. He is a journalist and author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. So welcome back to the show, Ivor.
Thank you. Happy again.
In the last segment, we talked about how much money the Beatles really didn't have, especially starting off. And you said you traveled with them for the 5 weeks during their first tour here, 1964. But did you stay in touch with them or tour with them later on in their careers?
Yes, I did. 1965 and 1966, I was based in Southern California. And whenever the Beatles came back, which they did in those years, I went with them to the Hollywood Bowl. I went with them to San Diego. I didn't do the whole tour in the successive years. And then years later, when John moved to L.A., I saw him. When Paul came to L.A., I spent time with him and his late wife, Linda. And when Ringo came, I saw him. So although we didn't keep in sort of intimate friendship details, I did see them and I did talk to them and I saw them as they evolved, magnificently evolved.
So what was the money situation like in 1965 and 66?
Well, to be honest with you, we didn't talk too much about money. But the Beatles were naive with money. It sounds crazy because today, as I'm sure you know, Ringo is worth a paltry 400 $100 million, and Paul is worth a bigger, slightly bigger amount of $1.3 billion. But back then, they weren't worth too much. And back then, of course, Brian Epstein, their manager, was a terrible businessman. Now, I know that sounds weird, but you've got to look at it this way. Brian came to the Cavern nightclub in Liverpool. He saw them. He saw promise in them. He took them on. He decided to manage them. The Beatles were thrilled to bits. But Brian was no businessman. And Brian actually, believe it or not, signed them and ended up taking something like 25% of their income. And then as the years evolved into the late 60s and early 70s, the Beatles suddenly woke up and said, hey, we haven't been ripped off, but we are not getting the money that we deserve. And of course, it evolved that they were not getting the money they deserved. And both John and Paul ended up, first of all, John got a guy called Klein, who was to be his manager when Brian Epstein died. And Paul had married Linda Eastman, and Linda Eastman was a photographer. And her father was a lawyer, and her brother was a lawyer. And they educated Paul about the fiscal specialty of being in the music business. And Paul realized that he had been taken for a royal ride by Brian. Brian didn't do it deliberately because Brian ran a furniture store. Brian ran his family's record store in their furniture store in Liverpool. So what did Brian know about financial dealings with rock stars? He didn't, but he was a man that tailored them into the lovable Beatles the world learned to love.
Right. For those who may not know the entire backstory of the Beatles, Brian Epstein, he created their image, especially right at the beginning, wearing the ties and all wearing the same type of suits and having a little bit neater haircut, even though it was still too long for the societal norms back then. So he was more of an image person. But you're right, running a furniture store, you don't have royalties on couches and chairs. And so he probably had never dealt with what the music, write a song, you get royalties off that if you license it properly.
Yes, and I must tell you that when their records came out, the Beatles got 1 penny per record divided between four. I mean, you can see that it wasn't big money to, get them luxury living. And so they later on handled it. And if we have a moment, I must tell you the classic story about the merchandising of the Beatles. Do we have time?
Oh, yeah. That? Oh, we have all the time in the world. Please take it.
You've got to realize that when they came to America, somebody said to Brian Epstein, Brian, what about merchandising? Now, merchandising, Brian didn't know exactly what that was. It was Beatle wigs and all the Beatle paraphernalia that is so much part of today's rock and roll music world. Brian said, Brian asked his lawyer, do you want to handle it? And the lawyer said, no, I don't want to bother with that. So Brian got a guy called Nicky Byrne to do it. Now, Nicky Byrne was a fairly sharp businessman, and he formed a company called Celtape. Celtape, which of course was Beatles spelled backwards. And he handled the Beatles American Tour merchandising. Well, one day, Nicky Byrne came to Brian and handed him a check for $10,000. And Brian, wow, he said, that's incredible. Thank you. Now what? How much of this do I owe you? Byrne looked a bit surprised and he said, no, Brian, that is your share. Because as you know, Brian, our deal is you get 10% and we get 90%.
Oh. Now,
suddenly, the light went on and Brian was absolutely thunderstruck. And then he realized that he had blundered badly and given away the family store, given away the Beatles. And he actually went to court in New York to try and get some of the money back over maybe a year-long civil case, and he managed to get some money back. But that gave you some idea of how about the ways of merchandising. Because as I said a moment ago, Heather, merchandising in the 60s was not a huge industry as it is today. And much later, I remember George said, I think he told me on one occasion, that Brian didn't get very good deals for us, and George cited the awful, awful one penny per record that they were getting from the EMI record. It was one of the worst merchandising deals in America. And in addition to that, Brian signed the Beatles to a three-picture deal with United Artists. Well, the Beatles didn't know they were committed to make three movies. The first movie was A Hard Day's Night, which, of course, did hugely well at the box office. But then the Beatles suddenly woke up the next day and Brian said, well, we've got two more movies to make. So they made the second movie, which was called Help. But they weren't crazy about making movies. And then the contract said, the Beatles must appear in the third movie. So they suddenly got wise and they made Yellow Submarine. Now, Yellow Submarine, as anybody who knows Beatles history, was an animated film. So the Beatles had to appear in it live. And if you see the movie, you will see an animated film for 98 minutes or 100 minutes. And then in the last scene, you will see the Beatles live appear and say a few words for end of film. Yeah. So the Beatles got their own back and they fulfilled their United Artists film commitment, and they realized that they had been not taken to the cleaners, but certainly were doing things they didn't expect. And if I may add, there is the fact that they were, well, I would say they were screwed out of their own music, because they got a tiny percentage when their songbook was sold to a company in England, and it took several years for them to sort it out, and several years before they started earning money from their own music and buying the rights back to their own song. So it was pretty disastrous, as you can see.
Yeah. And you can tell if we watch those movies, The Hard Day's Night, it looks like the lads were just having a lark in the whole movie and they thought it was fun. And then the second one, Help, they were going through the motions.
Yes, so you're absolutely right. Yeah, you hit it, you described it perfectly.
And then I did actually just see Yellow Submarine in a drive-in theater 2 weeks ago. It, actually, to me, what was really interesting in there is all the references to all the things that they liked. So they put in the old Hollywood movies and things that they really enjoyed in their personal lives. But that movie was trying to fill that 100 minutes.
Well, you remember that final scene in Yellow Submarine when suddenly, right at the end, almost as an afterthought, they show up in person. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I want to tell you that one of the things that was, not the saving grace, but one of the delights of getting to know the Beatles and traveling with them was that they had a sensational sense of humor. I mean, it was dry, it was funny. And when you saw A Hard Day's Night, that was the way the Beatles really were. And that was a film that captured, directed by the great film director, Dick Richard Lester. It was a funny film. It was amusing. It was a dry sense of humor, and it really, you saw what went on when the Beatles hit the road, or when they toured, or when they met the fans. That was it.
We need to take one more break. When we come back, we'll go into how did the Beatles fare after Brian Epstein departed their team. So we'll be right back with Ivor Davis. He's a journalist and author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. Welcome back to Money Making Sense, the show that talks about all things money. Today we are going into the money that the Beatles have. And actually at the beginning, they didn't have a whole lot of it. Joining me today is Ivor Davis. He is a journalist and author of The Beatles and Me on Tour. And I am so happy to talk to you, Ivor.
Thank you. Well, thanks for talking to me.
To me, it's fascinating. The money end of anything is completely fascinating to me. Because When you don't have it, you worry about it. But when you do, people aren't as stressed. But they don't think about how it affects your life day in and day out. And as we were talking earlier, you said that a lot of people don't ask you about how money affected the Beatles. They just want to hear glamorous stories or some gossip going on in their lives.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Heather. You see, what happens is I tell them the stories about the madness of the tour, but nobody is interested in the money, and the money is quite fascinating because I suddenly remembered, as you and I were talking a few minutes ago, was when I was traveling with the Beatles in 1964, I was in the next room, they had a big suite. And in those days, they didn't have security, so I was part of the Beatles family. I'd walk in and out of their suite, and John would say, grab a drink from the minibar, and I'd grab whatever. I wanted a beer or something. And the funny thing was, I learned from the Beatles that Brian Epstein, I mean, they were making a lot of money, but Brian was complaining, would you believe, that their minibar bill was excessive. I mean, doesn't that sound pretty bizarre? He said, hey, boys, you know, cut back on your drinks from the minibar. Yeah. crazy. But along those lines, I remember a few years later that Paul, once he got savvy, said something like, well, Brian had signed us up, and he used this phrase, to a long-term slave contract, particularly with the records. And as I mentioned to you a moment ago, the Beatles wised up and they formed Apple Records, which basically was to handle the finances. And today, Apple Records is an unbelievable organization that is really owned by Paul, Ringo, Yoko Ono, and George Harrison's widow. So they're the ones that get $100 million a year from without sneezing. So today the Beatles are not short of a few quid, as we used to say in England.
Right.
A quid is a pound, or was a pound. And so the Beatles, so don't cry for the Beatles Argentina. So anyway, because they're all right.
I do love that story of here are blokes, as you would say, that came from working class England. They were poor growing up, just didn't have a whole lot. So they didn't have any money savvy. And even Brian Epstein, who was middle class and wasn't struggling that much, he too didn't really understand the ins and outs of how much money could be made. So it takes a few years to learn that and understand how money can work for you. And I think this is a really great lesson for people.
I think it is. And the other thing I studied recalled was, don't forget, Brian was a cut above working class Beatles because he was from the business class. And when Brian came to see the Beatles at the Cavern nightclub and said he wanted to manage them, the Beatles were thrilled. They would have paid him. And the point I remember Paul saying that, well, we like Brian because he was upper class and, you ready for this? He had a car.
Mm.
Wow, that is unbelievable, isn't it? He had a car. And don't forget, the Beatles didn't have a recording contract. And I don't want to badmouth Brian. I hope it doesn't sound like I'm doing that. But Brian Epstein went on his own expense in late 1963 to New York because he knew he wanted to get them on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he went there and he made an appointment. He went to see Ed Sullivan, who had the biggest Sunday night variety show in America. And he persuaded Mr. Sullivan to put the Beatles on the show. And Ed Sullivan did. And at one time, Ed Sullivan said, they'll have to share billing with, I don't know, there was a performing mouse and a guy. I mean, it's ridiculous. But Brian said, no, they've got to get top billing. And Ed Sullivan gave the top billing. But I think for the two performances, the first performance was live. The second performance in February 1964 was done at a hotel in Miami. For the two performances, the Beatles were paid the princely sum of $5,000. Wow. So Brian would have done it for less, because Brian had the good sense to realize that the exposure on the Ed Sullivan Show would be their way to show America that they were ready for them, and that they were, you know, they were primed to come to America. And at least you've got to give Brian credit for that. That's exactly what happened. And as I said a few minutes ago, Heather, the Beatles came to America and they were triumphant. They were successful. They were sellouts. And that put them on the path to the riches they own today.
Oh, yeah. I think everyone is grateful for Brian and understands the contribution he made. It's just he was a little bit out of his league once he got to a certain level of fame. He just didn't understand it.
You have just hit the nail on the head, Heather. I mean, you get, as I say, you get a guy who runs a record store in his parents' furniture store. Now, how does he know about, as you said a few minutes ago, how does he know about movie contracts? Well, I mean, what he should have done was got a very savvy lawyer who was savvy to the ways of recording contracts, to the ways of movie contracts, and all that kind of stuff. But I want to tell you, I don't know if I mentioned this. I know in 1964, when I went with the Beatles, that they hated merchandising. John, particularly, hated the merchandising thing. And it, for some reason, it stank of commercialism. They didn't realize the riches were there. And so John, I remember, was just... one day I bought a Beatle wig for about, I don't know, 50 cents. And I took it proudly and I showed it to John in the hotel. And John looked at it. He went to the hotel window, opened the window and threw it out. So that gives you some idea of what they thought of merchandising. Of course, today merchandising is an integral part of the whole package, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I think that a lot of that was the society back then as well. It's similar to when you had amateur athletes versus professionals. A professional athlete was not looked upon very well in the 40s, 50s, and into the mid-60s.
Yes, you're right. And what was that then, Heather? Was it we're amateurs and therefore we should not profit?
It was more because you did it for the love of the sport and not because of love of money. That is my take on on that whole thing. If you were doing it for the money, then that made you somehow dirty.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So you sound a very young woman, Heather. So I wouldn't. So back in those days, I mean, you didn't experience that, obviously, but you learned about it and it kind of tainted you, didn't it? Tainted you if you went that route.
Yeah, no, I am a great studier of history because I think it teaches you so much more going into the future.
Stay tuned for part two of my conversation with Ivor Davis. That's coming up on the next episode of Money Making Sense. Thanks for listening. You can email me with any questions or topics you want to hear about at hkelly@ksl.com. That's H-K-E-L-L-Y at ksl.com. And because this is Money Making Sense, you can subscribe for free on Spotify, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you listen to your favorite podcast, and you'll never miss another episode.
Thanks for being a Money Making Sense listener. Follow your common sense on the social media, Money Making Sense, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.